My name is Dan Spencer. I'll be moderating the forum tonight. I'm one of the summer program co-coordinators. And tonight's topic is liberation finally coming to South Africa? We are fortunate to have in the village this week several people who can help us get further into this conversation, and I'll introduce them in just a moment. But we were sitting here chatting just a moment ago about what's been happening in South Africa, in fact, the whole area of Southern Africa in the last year. And Solveig remarked and said, we were talking about the snowballing kind of events and the momentum that's been building in South Africa. And we commented, is it only last October that the eight ANC, the African National Congress leaders, were released, which in some ways has triggered many of the events that have developed since, culminating in Nelson Mandela's release this winter, and now the negotiation on the re-legalization of an African National Congress and several other anti-apartheid organizations in South Africa, to the point where now we're seeing negotiations between the government and the formerly banned African National Congress. So it's been a fascinating year to watch this development, and somebody commented recently that Nelson Mandela has become one of the most, if not the most, recognized figure in the world today because of the international attention that's focused on South Africa throughout all of this. So it's a timely discussion. We're grateful to have the folks we've got on our panel here. Let me just introduce them briefly. To my right is Jim Knudsen, who spent 18 years as a missionary in South Africa, and then the past 17 years as the Mission Secretary for Africa, first for the American Lutheran Church, and since the merger of the Lutheran churches, with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And to my immediate left, Solveig Chessip, for 15 years has been focusing on Southern Africa concerns as the Director of National Namibia Concern. And she's been giving sessions this week on Namibia, Jim on South Africa, and will continue to do so after this. And then to my far left is Janelle DeGrucci, who I met here 7 years ago when she was visiting with her family. Janelle is from South Africa. Her dad teaches and has written several books on the church struggle against apartheid in South Africa. And Janelle is a medical student from Cape Town and spending some time in the United States this year. Has very graciously, several times this summer, shared her perspectives as a South African citizen on what is happening in the struggle in South Africa. So they're going to begin with some brief introductions to a few key points, and then we want to get the discussion going. I'll just mention again that the purpose of Holden Village Forums is not to try to reach any consensus around these lively topics that we choose, but rather to get the arguments out there and to have us have a chance to, through discussing with each other, to learn more about the issue, regardless of the perspectives and the viewpoints we bring. So we encourage and hope for a lively discussion, expect some disagreement, and hope that at the end of the hour we will all feel better informed and more stimulated on the topic. With that, I will turn it over to Jim to get us going.
Okay, as Dan said, brief, and try to do that. He's already mentioned something we're all aware of, the way events have been snowballing in that part of the world, in Namibia and in South Africa. There are a couple things I'd just like to highlight, and some of you I know are aware of these and are informed, but one thing that we read about and hear about is what is called black-on-black violence. That's the word that's used. And it is a disturbing development. In Natal, the province of Natal alone, in the last 3 years, 3,500 black people at least have been killed in this kind of fighting. It's basically been between people who belong to Nkata, organization headed by Chief Gacha Buthelezi, who's also the chief minister, prime minister of KwaZulu, on the other side, people from the United Democratic Front and the African National Congress. Now, some of this has broken out recently in Transvaal, up around Johannesburg, in near Johannesburg, and recently in the Port Elizabeth area, in the Cape area, and this is among coloreds or people of mixed race. So that's a disturbing development. I read somewhere these last days that already this year, in this kind of violence in South Africa, 1,500 people have been killed, and the total for last year in the country was about 1,400. So this is one thing that certainly concerns everyone. And as an anonymous person in the quote in the New York Times on August 11th said he was a militant, but he asked to be remain anonymous, said that the suspension of the armed struggle, and we'll touch on that as we go through, does not impact severely on the level of violence in the townships, This is largely dictated by other factors now, by intergroup rivalries rather than the direct protest against the party. And that's a tough situation there. Another thing is the right-wing violence. And we are reading now about bombs being thrown into places where Africans are meeting, African hotels, African bars, African stores, from the far right wing. Not as many have been killed, but there has been this. And there is that group that says we'd rather fight and die than be under a black government. And the police themselves, since February, 140 have been killed by the police and 1,400 or more injured, who knows how many. There's still many, many people in detention. The estimates are from 1,000 to 3,000 who are political prisoners. So there's violence on both sides. By starting out with what is called black on black, just to highlight some of the problems, not to say that there isn't violence on both sides. Now there's been the agreement, and those of us that have been kind of out of it don't know a lot of the details, but there was an agreement. The ANC agreed to immediate suspension of guerrilla war, no infiltration into South Africa from anybody outside, and cessation of any attacks officially organized or launched by ANC leadership within South Africa. The government has agreed to release political prisoners by April 1991. Again, up to 3,000 need to be released, and there are 20,000 exiles or so overseas that need to be repatriated. They've agreed to review security legislation and repeal it. And now the Natal thing that I start out with has got to get special attention. And Mandela said, you got to rein in the police down in Natal. You got to do something about that. The police seem to have been too pro-Inkatha down there. There's a real urgency on both sides. There's a feeling that this is the time right now on the side of both the black and the whites. There are rising expectations on the side of the blacks. They want things to happen quickly. Economically, the business people, the people on the other side realize that if things are going to change, there have to be changes so that they can have more freedom. So on both sides, there's a real urgency. Mandela now is dealing with the young blacks who don't want negotiations, who want, say, you'll never get anything negotiating these people. De Klerk has those on the far right that say, you're selling the store, you're selling out on us, and we're going to fight. So they're both dealing with that. The black political organizations want something to happen very soon, and one can understand that. So now they have been meeting again, and the question is what is happening the beginning of, as someone has said, I think even Mandela was quoted over BBC, is this the beginning of an alliance? The ANC, or most of the ANC, and part of the Nationalist Party, is this the beginning of something or not? I'll leave it there.
Janelle.
Like Dan said, I'm a medical student from Cape Town, South Africa. I've grown up in South Africa. I'm about fourth generation or so. I just want to mention I've been out of the country since November, so picked a kind of a bad time to be in the States because I missed a lot of developments and things move very quickly generally, but especially at this time. So I'll probably be quite out of it when I go back. And I guess I'm going to just speak briefly about where I locate myself in the struggle and how I see the vision of a free South Africa. I'm a white English-speaking South African and have grown up in the country and therefore part of the apartheid society. And that brings with it a lot of baggage. I went to a white English-speaking government school. I lived in a white neighborhood all my life. I watched state TV, etc., etc. There's a lot of indoctrination that goes on for all people. But I see myself as lucky because I've come from kind of a progressive family. I've lived in liberal Cape Town. And I've gone to liberal university and have been involved in political organizations and have been part of the anti-apartheid movement through most of my life. I think South Africa is a very exciting, challenging place. It's also a very painful place to live. Yeah, so like I say, I see myself as a part of the mass democratic movement, which, just to explain very briefly, is, it consists of, it's a term that is now used to describe the main movement of people, and it's United Democratic Front, the ANC, the main trade unions, and various individual church leaders, etc., etc. That's the mass democratic movement. So I see myself as a part of that, and belong to organizations that are part of that, and subscribing to the vision of a non-racial, non-sexist, democratic, and unitary country. I think for me, recent developments have brought a lot of hope. To see Mandela, who, I'm 25, so my whole life he's been in jail, and I've lived, I mean, he's been on the island, which you can see in Cape Town, until he was moved in later years, and to just live with that legend who's been in jail, to have him released, to live where the ANC, you never mentioned the word ANC at all, you know, unless it was whispered, you'd never wear the colors. It was extremely clandestine. To have that, all those kind of restrictions lifted, to me is just amazing psychological difference. And so those kind of developments I see as very hopeful, the whole negotiation process. And I just want to read part of one of the guiding documents of the mass democratic movement is the Freedom Charter, which was drawn up in 1955 by the ANC and other organizations at the Congress of the People. And it's used by organizations of the mass democratic movement a lot as policy kind of document. And that says that South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white. And it also says that only a democratic state, based on the will of all the people, can secure to all their birthrights without distinction of color, race, sex, or belief. And that really encompasses that non-racial vision of all South Africans uniting and working out a just and equal society. I guess I'll just end briefly with saying, whilst there is all this hope and this movement and this excitement, which comes across a lot in phone conversations before I came to Holden, and in letters now, I guess it's always tempered by this but, and this but is the violence in Natal, or the latest thing in Port Elizabeth, the feeling that, you know, what has actually changed on the ground? You know, nothing's really changed in some ways. It might be only a few years before there's a majority government, but what is the legacy of apartheid? And how do we overcome that legacy? How do we overcome the violence of the society? How do we overcome the racial segregation, the racism, the entrenched things like group areas and Bantustans, etc., etc.? So, I guess that was something.
Okay, as the person on this panel who has spent the least time in South Africa, I've been asked to talk a little bit about U.S. Policy regarding Africa. And to speak of U.S. policy regarding Africa is in a sense to talk about the lack of policy, because the continent as a whole has been considered a place of really only marginal interest to the United States, with one exception, and that is when the great global struggle, when it came to be seen as part, as a pawn, the various nations of Africa, a pawn in the East-West struggle. And then we got quite excited. Now we have had some more interest in South Africa because we considered its location strategic, its minerals strategic, it was in our self-interest. But really, the first president to have seemed to have noticed South Africa was John F. Kennedy. And it was through his interest and his concern about apartheid that way back then the arms embargo we participated in, and that supposedly has been in force all this time. But then Southern Africa certainly was ignored basically until when Nixon took office. He assigned Henry Kissinger, among other things, to do studies of U.S. foreign policy in various parts of the world. And the results of these studies, which were supposedly intended to be top secret, the result of the Southern Africa region was somehow leaked, and it was published, actually, by someone in Great Britain. Made it very interesting reading, because the conclusions after 6 or 8 months of study was that the current minority governments would remain in power for the foreseeable future. And therefore, although we had started conversations with some of the leaders of the liberation groups, these conversations were to end. We were to fully support the white minority regimes, because they would be in power, they would take care of our interests, they would be dependable trading partners. Well, this was this report was probably 3 years old only when both Angola and Mozambique became independent. And then 5 years later, Zimbabwe, Rhodesia became Zimbabwe, and suddenly the people that we had decided that we no longer needed to talk to, we had suddenly they were the governments in these areas. So we were wrong again. But except kind of briefly during the Carter administration and the attention to human rights, except for that period, the policy didn't seem to change. Even though the realities had changed. And even under Carter, we vetoed, for example, I've been working with Namibia, and absolutely every time a resolution would come up at the United Nations condemning South Africa's invasions of Angola and so forth, the United States would veto it, which was terribly frustrating. And that continued even under Carter, even with that flicker of interest in human rights. For the most part, our attitude towards South Africa has been that a rather comfortable cooperation with a valued trading partner. It's strategically located. We're dealing with whites. Certainly there has to be racism. I mean, this is who we felt comfortable dealing with, a nation that probably shared our feelings about racism, whether they were spoken or not. And certainly one of the things that made us feel right at home in in being South Africa's partner was their very strong anti-communist stance. We felt very much at home with that. And so I have to say, our stance has at times been so insensitive that it's simply hard to believe. The U.S. ambassador to South Africa during the Nixon administration went to Robben Island. Mandela was there. He didn't go to see Mandela. He went to go hunting, and some of the prisoners retrieved the birds. I mean, just a crassness. It hasn't always been quite that extreme, but we haven't been real sensitive there. Under President Reagan, we had the Chester Crocker, who was certainly, by all accounts, the best trained, the most on Africa. He was an African specialist, and his dream was that a policy called constructive engagement would bring South Africa around. And it was that we shouldn't continue to ostracize South Africa. We should encourage them and offer them many, many carrots and very few sticks. And in the opinion of many, many people, that was a disastrous failure. In 1986, the U.S. Congress was able to impose partial sanctions. This was done over President Reagan's veto and certainly over President Bush's opposition. Although it has been interesting that recently President Bush said yes, there is an indication that sanctions have been effective. But basically, we're real comfortable, I think, as a country, dealing with the white minority government of South Africa. This summer, I was in Minnesota, and just an article in the Minneapolis Star, de Klerk, unlikely to see adoring crowds, but he has allies in the White House. And it says, there won't be a rally at Yankee Stadium when de Klerk comes to visit, and no one will make t-shirts. But he can count on warm support from the White House, because he is officialdom's champion. And, he is given, really, basically, he is given credit for the way the situation is now, for the hope that is seen. And I think, it said, another reason is habit. We're just used to dealing with white minority governments in South Africa. And it will take a lot, I think, to kind of change our thinking.
Okay, well, we've heard a lot of different things in terms of just laying out some of the basic problems of recent developments in the country, some of the perspective of what it's like to grow up and now be confronted with a sudden rapid development, but is there any real change going on behind that, and some of the U.S.'s own history and policy in there. Let's open it up now and see what you all think in terms of getting at this question, is liberation finally coming to South Africa? What are some of your questions on that? What are some of your own perspectives and viewpoints? And get some dialogue going in the room here.
I think it's interesting that Archbishop Tutu had to come to the United States. Years and years ago, he came to a little retreat place for the Episcopal Church in Cove, Oregon. It's in eastern Oregon. And we went there and heard him. It was the little camp. And we camped out, had a tent, and so on. And he had his daughter there and her baby, I think, at that time. Anyhow, he was saying, he said it wouldn't do for then Bishop Tutu to be thrown in jail for advocating sanctions against South Africa in Cove, Oregon. But that man stumped the United States just like a presidential campaign. He was everywhere. He spoke at the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma and packed the chapel. They're all doing it. Mandela came. Now look what we did when Mandela came. Why do all these people have to come to the United States to do their political campaigns? We have too much influence in those countries. It's awful. I don't want him to come here and do that. I want him to go. I want Bishop Tutu to go and be able to be free in his own country and go all over his country and say what ought to happen. I mean, he was not quite banned, but it was because the people in the United States screamed and yelled that he got out of the country to come to the Council of Churches up in Vancouver, Canada. And he came in on the airplane at midnight and was met by about 2,000 people up in Canada. So it just seems kind of bizarre to me somehow that we should be in this situation. I mean, God bless them for coming here and trying to, they lean on us to get us to lean on our leaders to do the right thing. And I find that it must be terribly difficult for them. I mean, it's hard enough for our own people to run for office in this country and get elected, but to get elected in Africa by running in the United States.
Janelle, would you be interested in addressing what the perception inside South Africa is of the U.S. role and the U.S. power in influencing events there?
Well, I guess just two things. One is, I know that there would be people in South Africa who would be very unhappy that Mandela would come to the States at this point. Because, well, for various reasons, one being his health and being under pressure, and that includes the whole world tour, and the other being the fact that he's needed in the country so badly. But I guess Mandela, being the statesperson he is, knows the power of international politics and the fact that he has to go out there, come out here, and he has to advocate certain things or push certain things. And I think the fact is that the United States has a large finger in the South African pie. There's no question about that. I think on the ground inside the country, the United States is seen, is looked at very suspiciously, extremely suspiciously. And I think that it's not only their history in the region, but their history of involvement in other countries in the world.
I want to go back to the increasing violence among peoples there and to get your reactions to how you see that being resolved. You know, in terms of when you were saying that would the police come in, which police? Would it be is there a mixed racial police? Because what we see in the papers here generally are black police. You know, what are the implications for that? Is that going to feed into the white minority, some white minority who's saying, look, they're savage, they can't even do X, Y, and Z with their own people? So it seems to me a very ominous thing, and I'm not sure what a creative solution is or what's being talked out about within South Africa. And what those of us, again, in this country can do to support the nonviolent movements that might be a leaven there.
Well, I think Janelle, let's try that together. Janelle, there are a couple of things. In Natal, the KwaZulu police are under Cratchit Buthelezi, who is the Minister of Law and Order, he is the head of the police in his own country. One of the things they said is he must get those police out of there right away. I mean, that's a rather obvious thing, because in these clashes, they usually support the one side or they stand by and let this happen. And that's what Mandela is saying. That's not a final answer. That's not going to settle it. But just to kind of cool it, get your police out of here. And even if it said it's even better if South African police came in there. I mean, the regular South African police, who are both black and white, and they've done some terrible things. But de Klerk is, I have the feeling, and I'm far away from there, de Klerk is trying, he called this special meeting, wasn't it 500 police officers, I think it was, at a special meeting to tell them to cool it. And we're starting a new regime here, and must be kind of puzzling for them all these years to be kind of given free rein to do anything you want, and now being told, cool it, we're trying to work things out and don't around mess things up. Now some of them are still doing it. Most of the white police are members of the Conservative Party or even farther right. And they just delight in some of this bashing. That's just one statement. Some of this, when that country's been in such a terrible state for all these years, this is just, things just are breaking loose all over the place. And I'm not answering your question, but And then there are whites who use that as an argument and say, well, look, these people can't govern themselves. Even Reagan referred to that. That's got nothing to do with it. You pin up a bunch of people in a cage for so many years, and then you give them an ounce of freedom, and you know this. And as this African himself said, there are all kinds of rivalries that start coming out. And then also Natal, once it starts, it's like a feud. And there are people, I've read interviews where people have said they don't really know the ideological background of the two sides. They have some idea. They just know those people have killed their family. Last night my mother and brother were killed, tonight I'm going to get them. Mm-hmm. And then they're also told, of course, that the ANC are communists. The communists are going to come and take over our country. They're still told that stuff. So all that stuff is fed in. And obviously, a lot of both the far right and the far left are beyond the control of both Mandela and de Klerk, and that's a scary thing. Just because they made that statement, some of the stuff in Port Elizabeth broke out after the statement of the cessation. At the same time, I think, and there Janelle could be most helpful, there are a lot of, quote, non-violent things that are working. They're rent.
It's like a gross example of divide and rule. And the government picking a side and backing that side. I mean, in Cape Town, we had that with the burning of Crossroads. I don't know if people remember 1985, when the government used a group of people in the squatter camp and armed them, and they wiped out the houses of the other group, 100,000 homeless, and the government was then able to take all those homeless people, shift them into the new township that they wanted them to go in the first place. So this is on a much larger scale in Natal, that the government has always backed Gacha Buthelezi to a certain extent. Gacha is a wonderful hypocrite in that he's always held up the fact that he's the non-violent leader, whereas the ANC is the armed struggle. I'm not violent, I don't agree with the armed struggle, etc., etc. But his MPs, his Zulu warriors are armed to the teeth. And I guess it really started escalating in 1985, I would say. With the rise of the United Democratic Front, the uprisings throughout the whole country, with the UDF being in a leading role in that throughout the country. But in Zululand, in KwaZulu, just hitting against Inkatha. So you have Zulu, who are both a UDF and both... Who are UDF and Zulu, who are Inkatha. And Inkatha being armed and being supported by the KwaZulu police, which Jim said, and the South African police. So the clash is starting way back in 1985. And I think there's the ideological level, there's also the economic level, which is how it also operated in Crossroads. People want land, and they're fighting for subsistence and access to certain basic things. And then you have the whole history of feuds and stuff coming in. And then the last point that I wanted to make about that is that as I understand it, part of the recent escalation is Gacha Buthelezi seeing his hold, his position of power in the politics of the country, he's losing that position because of the release of Mandela. Mandela has come out extremely strong. I mean, it's ANC and the Nationalist Party. Those are the two main negotiating people. And Gacha is losing out. KwaZulu is losing out. He's being sidelined. And I think that this is also his attempt to hold on to some of that power.
And then the non-violent kind of things that a lot of that don't get in the in the press.
I don't. Yeah.
You know, the whole economic thing. There have been many. There were for years the Africans weren't able to do this, but they have literally paralyzed some stores in some towns. They have boycotted all the stores because the main economic power is in the hands of the blacks, and they're the main buyers. And they have they've changed some things, even in places like Boksburg, up near Johannesburg. The school boycott, the rent boycotts. We're told that in some of the townships, it's been years since the Africans have paid rent because they're protesting the poor services that they get for the rent, the poor lights, the poor water, and everything. And a lot of the townships are really not governed anymore by the government. They're governed by local organizations. And that's both good and bad. But you got to kind of get that sort of work together, too. You get a little bit of anarchy in that, too. So these huge townships are almost not governed anymore. And there are a lot of local organizations that have grown up. So there is this emphasis on nonviolence, the mine strikes, which sometimes tend to turn to violence because of violence of the police. Many years ago, they tried these kind of things, and it didn't work because they couldn't organize, and also there weren't unions. Now they have unions, and as you know, the unions are legal, and they can strike, and so they have some power they didn't have before. So that whole union thing is another part of this. And with Gotcha, I'd just like to say, coming back, just because our government has always championed him, Janelle alluded to that, as the person against violence. And I'm afraid that there are going to be people in this country that are going to continue to do that. And if things get tough in South Africa, they're going to say, we as the U.S. ought to back Gotcha Buthelezi, not Mandela. We should watch for that. In polls that were taken among Africans during these past years, about 75% of the Africans or more, and these were, you know, kind of polls that they did informally, but among a lot of people, 75% or more said they were in favor of Tutu, Busak, ANC, that whole constellation, and only about 15% or less were in favor of Gotcha Buthelezi. But often in our press or the government, they say he is the real leader, and I think that could be a divisive thing.
Maybe I could also just say about the non-violence thing again, that the United Democratic Front has always used only non-violent action. The ANC has been the one that's been involved in the armed struggle, and they've been external. And the UDF has been internal, and it's always civil disobedience campaigns or non-violent action. Although, you know, that often, you know, when you have a rally and the police attack, you know, there's often...
I had one just for information out of my ignorance. On the ANC's concept of democracy, when you see posters and things like that, it says one person, one vote, which is certainly a big part of democracy. But another part of democracy, I think, is basic human rights, like in the United States, which is not a perfect democracy by any means, but at least there's the Bill of Rights, which says, in effect, that there are certain rights that people have, which even if you had a majority vote, cannot be taken away from the people. So it's sort of a combination of majority rule plus basic inalienable rights. And I wondered if that is part of the ANC's thinking of democracy, or is it strictly a we want a majority rule kind of democracy state?
I think it definitely is.
Did you have the Freedom Charter?
The Freedom Charter. The excerpt that I read from the Freedom Charter,
right,
that outlines a whole lot of those. The basic beliefs, the rights of individuals and people.
Yeah, the whole Freedom Charter is really pretty clear on the protecting of individual.
I was trying to listen as you read that, and I didn't feel that. I mean,
I read a clause.
Okay.
It's it's a lot longer than that.
Yeah.
It's a document, and that was from 1955, and that's still the basic thing.
That has to be worked out, but I'm somewhat hopeful that they will also look at the Namibians. And also, the Mandela group is, as I think you have seen from the reading here, is a very sensible group of people. That whole leadership cadre, I have a lot of faith in them. If they can work with the South Africans, there are others who would say nuts, you know, on both sides, but they really are sensible. And they'd be willing to. The fact that they've gone as far as they have in the negotiation, I think the ANC, and given on some points, certain points, shows they know there has to be compromise. There are certain things that they won't compromise on. But that's one thing too. One praise is his health. You know that he's an old man and he's tired. But he and then some of the young men are really good, but they look to him. Thabo Mbeki is just brilliant, I think. You know, when you hear him speak, it's just amazing. And then men like Chris Hani who was one of the leaders of the violent part, has said, "We bow to our Father now. Now we accept Him, saying we're going to work this out nonviolent." So there's real hope, and I have faith that they can do this if they're allowed to go through with it. And the question is, will they? Again, there's tempered optimism. The headline in an article, then in our, not to plug our paper, but Frank Wright is a very well-known columnist in the Minneapolis Tribune, is traveling around Southern Africa now. And I was kind of frightened when I saw, and not totally surprised, July 29th, South Africa's hopes fading in light of growing tension. And Frank's been around a lot in a lot of countries. Now, you know, that's one side of it, but as Janelle said, there's a lot of fear, and yet there's hope, but that's why they have to move fast. And as they move fast, there are going to be problems. The PAC, Pan-Africanist Congress, are going to feel left out. Buthelezi is going to feel left out.
I'm sorry.
Did you want to follow up on that, Dave?
Well, maybe I just ought to read the Freedom Charter. But could you say anything more about that? I mean, does the Freedom Charter spell out certain basic rights that ought to be in a new constitution for the governing of the South Africa? Is that what's being advocated? So there would be something comparable to the Bill of Rights?
We have it. I have it up in some books. I don't have it right here. We can show it to you. Maybe
okay.
We can
great.
Show it to you. I have it. I know it's one of the books I have.
But let me just follow just that. As I understand it, that is one of the hotly debated issues right now, that the white minority wants to have their status protected. And that's one of the big things that's being debated now.
And they won't get everything they want. But my point is, I think Mandela and that group are wise enough, as was Mugabe in Zimbabwe, to allow some compromise, if they're allowed to do it. And I think they are. But they're not going to give the whites everything they want. They're not going to take away everything either. I don't think they've lived together too long, and they've struggled together, and they're one South. They know they need one South Africa. That's what they want.
Yeah, I read just a small article, a brief article, that Tutu and Mandela had both admitted to a long-time communist background recently. I don't even know whether that's true. Why would it come out now? Does that have any implications either in the country or from the perspective outside of the country?
Well, the South African Communist Party and the ANC have always been in an alliance. They were kind of banned together, and they've been in exile together, and certain of the leading figures have been in both groups. They aren't the same organization by any means, but it's always been a working alliance. When the ANC was banned in February, this SACP, South African Communist Party, was also unbanned. And you often see the SACP and ANC flags flown at rallies together. And just in July, the SACP was launched in the country. Joe Slovo is one of the leading figures in that. I don't know if you know him. He was a leading figure in SACP, and he was also commander of the military wing of the ANC before Chris Hani. There's been a long tradition of communist involvement.
I would like to know
where
you got that, because there are papers. I'd be very interested to know where you got that, especially about Tutu. I mean, I'd like to see the source.
It was just a Los Angeles Times or USA Today, just a real brief thing. It was during our vacation, so I just briefly glanced at it.
Because I know people say that. I can remember when placards, even in Minneapolis, a guy standing outside there when someone had come to speak about South Africa, Tutu was a communist. That's nothing new, but my point is, at this point, it's incredible. I mean, a man like, I guess we know what we believe, and that's the most important thing, but I hate to see this kind of stuff being spread around. And also, what does it mean that Mandela is a communist? We can go into that. The Communist Party supported the ANC, as you know, from the beginning. ideologically and with arms when they took the armed struggle. The Scandinavian countries gave the main financial support, which has always been embarrassing to us conservative Midwestern Lutherans who, you know, are so afraid of this communist outfit. And here their main support has come from the Scandinavian Lutherans, you know, the countries of Scandinavia. Because we wouldn't help the ANC, they got help from other places. But that doesn't make them communists. Just like Solvay said, you know, the Swapo people, they're sons and daughters. They're Lutheran brothers and sisters. And the same with the people in ANC. It doesn't make you communist because you take help from a communist anymore. It makes you a capitalist to take help from a capitalist. But we spread this stuff, and it's been used so much by South Africa back here in the States. It helped to defeat Dick Clark in Iowa. They come back here and because they know what sells in Peoria. And this anti-communism business, and to have them drumming it up now, I mean, it just really blows my mind. A man like Tutu, I mean, a deep spiritual man, read, you know, I'm not talking to you, but just read his stuff. And those of us who know him and have heard him preach and have prayed with him, you know, it's just incredible that someone would drag this up now. And that's why I'm wondering where it's coming from. That's a little diatribe, but that's
heaven.
I mean, it's just incredible when you know him, especially.
Paul Harvey mentioned the same thing. I didn't hear it. Yeah. I had it told to me.
Paul Harvey. For what reason and what does it mean and where is it coming from?
I don't know the context other than that someone said, "Did you know that Paul Harvey just said blah blah?"
And for what? I mean, Mugabe is a Christian Marxist. Yeah. So what? I mean, he's a wonderful man. For one thing, I think it's hard for us Westerners to believe that it's possible. I think that's part of it, that an African can be a Christian and also believe in certain economic principles of Marxism, you know, or communism. Whereas in the West, you can't. If you have that word, you can't be a Christian Marxist. Mugabe says, that's what I am. And I go to church on Sunday and pray, and I can follow some of these principles. But with us, you know, we can't accept that. And then we have this terrible phobia, almost. But it's to have it come up now. And also look at what Mandela says.
I would guess that this is entirely off the wall, because isn't Bishop Tutu right now being criticized by some of his own priests because he has said they may not even join the ANC? I would think it's wild. But one of the things that Jim has said and that we have to be aware of is the amount of propaganda that South Africa has been disseminating year after year after year in this country. We used to see figures, you know, millions of dollars going into propaganda in the United States. And that certainly was the most effective smear against SWAPO, the most effective, because at least until the last few months, when some of the sharp divisions are starting to be a little fuzzy between the East and the West, at least until the last few months, that was absolutely, communism was a word that people in this country reacted to just automatically. And so I was saying earlier tonight, it was interesting that charges of communism or socialism against the SWAPO, for example, leaders weren't made in Europe, where this is not the big red herring that it is in this country. So they are very shrewd at targeting. But I would guess if he is telling his Anglican priests they cannot become a member of a political party, I can't imagine that he is admitting that he has been a long-time communist. It doesn't make sense.
You know, and the South African people have suffered under a system that has been as brutal and cruel to them as any communist system. So when you talk to them about this, they kind of laugh at you. Mm-hmm. And they say, what are you talking about? Our problem is not communism or capitalism. It's having our doors kicked in the middle of the night and getting thrown in prison for 27 years. I mean, the brutality it's been terrible. So when you get, it's kind of almost academic with them, they'll take help from wherever they can get it. But certainly with 75% of the South Africans being Christian, as 95% of the Namibians, you know where their basic, at least basic loyalty and commitment is. So, you know, I think to bring this stuff up now, it's interesting, there are people who do it, but I don't think we have to be afraid. And also Russia has, another part of this whole equation is Russia has backed off, and as we talked about Namibia, they have encouraged, they've told ANC, we're not going to continue to back the armed struggle. It's not going to work. There was a time when there was a belief in the world that the ANC and others could overthrow the South African government in the military struggle. Russia, with their whole, you know, the whole glasnost thing, perestroika, has said, we're not going to back armed struggle. They're backed out of Cuba. They're backed out of other places. And so there's not even the threat, even in South Africa anymore, of a communist takeover, which is one of their big things before, the onslaught, the communists are going to take over. That's gone.
I'll do something to that about this business of communism. I think we really need to learn to perk our ears up when we hear this word communist and the kind of reaction that it gives us, because, like these people have been saying, in our country, it has been, we've been getting this propaganda our whole lives about the evil of communism. I'm not trying to support communism at all, but I had to note the reaction that I had in myself, Solveig, when you were talking about what was happening in Namibia and all, and again now in South Africa, all the evil things that the white government has done there, and you know, you're just kind of appalled at what's being done. And then at some point you mentioned, well, they had made this claim that maybe the black leaders were communist in some way, and then there was somewhere back in my head, somewhere in my mind, something that clicked and said, well, okay, we've got to be a little more careful, then they might be communist. So, I mean, this stuff is really deeply embedded. I just came back from several months in Sweden, and one of the things that struck me the most when I was in Sweden is that the people in Sweden did not fear communism in the same way. And that's what you were saying about Europe in general. They don't have this big fear. They fear the United States as much as they fear the Soviet Union. And I was trying to reflect on why that is. Sweden is a country, like other countries in Europe, that has been a country for hundreds of years, thousands of years, perhaps. The same people growing and dying, living and dying. And it's got a history that goes back a long ways. They've always been Swedish. Their identity is as Swedish people. Even if kings have come and gone, you know, their identity has stayed the same. Whereas in America, we're a young country. In fact, many of our Scandinavian ancestors, if you're Scandinavian, just came 100 years ago. And we're such a huge country, we're in such a mix, that I think we're still kind of trying to figure out who we are. We have political leaders every 4 years that try to tell us who we are and define us in terms of, you know, we're the providers of democracy for the world. So I think in some collective sense we sense this instability, our newness, and this produces at the same time a lot of paranoia. And it is communism, this Red Scare, that has been the monster under our bed, has been the kind of the unexplainable evil, has been the devil that's going to threaten our country. So it is, in some very deep psychological sense, this fear of communism has been embedded. And I think there still has to be some holdups. We have to learn that when we hear that term, it's not the deep bad thing that maybe we have always been taught that it is.
Mm-hmm. We're winding down here. I wonder if any of you have any closing comments that you'd like to make in light of the conversation. Maybe come back to the question that we've been sort of talking around, but give us your thoughts on, is liberation finally coming to South Africa? What are you, Janelle?
I guess I said it in my spiel in the beginning, that the answer is yes. I think in a few years there will be a majority government, but I think that justice and peace and equality will be a good few years longer down the road.
Sylvia, any final thoughts?
Well, I would say yes, the momentum, it will never be stopped now. I think one of the real dangers is how many of our eggs are in the Mandela basket. And I think he has tried to diffuse this somewhat by always portraying himself as not, you know, an individual, but a part of the ANC. But, you know, you just fear for this person, because it has taken a person of this stature to sort of be there and deal with de Klerk. And I think that's a real frightening thing, to think of how much weight is on his shoulders. And
Yeah, I would agree. And, there's so much that needs to be done in such a short time, and that's what's frightening, the dismantling of this system. The fact that 87% of the land belongs to 13% of people, and the economics, the education. Hopefully, in the new government, if it is a majority government at what time, will be given the time to work this out. It's going to take years. What has been done, especially in the last 40 years, is incredible, just incredible. And how you can work that out and have time to do it, that's what one has to be really concerned about.
Very good. Well, I want to thank all of our panelists and thank all of you for coming, and hope the conversation continues.